This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. A week after the rioting and deadly siege of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, and on this day of the vote in the House of Representatives to impeach President Donald Trump for a second time, we want to share a conversation that included two scholars on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Chandra Ward is Assistant Professor of Sociology here at UTC, and Jonathan McNair is the Ruth S. Holmberg Professor of American Music. Earlier this week, I spoke with them and with Marcus Ellsworth, the co-host of the Ground Game Georgia podcast, a spoken word artist and an activist here in Chattanooga. Chandra, Jonathan, Marcus, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
We first began having these conversations after the death of George Floyd. We now resume our conversations in a new year and following the events of last week at the U.S. Capitol, January 6th, 2021. There's a lot to talk about, and there will be a lot to talk about for quite a while. Your thoughts?
Well, my immediate thoughts when on January 6th, watching the riots unfold, watching this attempted insurrection and this threat to not just the people who were trying to conduct the business of this country inside the Capitol, but also like democracy and the U.S. itself. And watching how easily they walked in, how this group of violent insurrectionists faced almost no resistance and were allowed to take the building for at least a time. And I thought back to the Black Lives Matter protests in DC. This is, you know, we did start this conversation with, you know, the uprisings around George Floyd's murder, and how those protesters, who were largely peaceful, were met with military force before they even gathered. How there were dozens of arrests immediately, how there were incidents of people being tear gassed and beaten by cops, not just in DC, but across this country. And then here I am on January 6th, and I'm watching a band of white supremacist, anti-Semitic, hateful bigots mob the Capitol as if they'd made a reservation to go see Statuary Hall. And I think that's reflective of what the real problem in this country is that we not only are lax when it comes to white supremacy in this country and everybody who benefits from it and manipulates it for their personal gain, like President Trump does, but we aid and abet it systematically. We have it so ingrained in our institutions that the police and the military all stood down and were blocked from protecting our Capitol. And they did more to stop people who were just trying to raise awareness of the inequities in our systems than the people who actually want to overthrow the system entirely.
Yeah, to piggyback off of Marcus's comments, when you asked the question, Ray, I was silent because on the one hand, there's so much to say, and simultaneously, I'm speechless at the events surrounding last week. And it does very much tie into the protests from last summer by Black Lives Matter activists, allies, supporters in regards to racial justice, and how people of color are met with police forces. And so to have an example before our eyes of how different groups are treated disparately, to have that juxtaposition just really makes the case plain as day. Hopefully, not all people will see it that way. So in 2021, the message is we're still dealing with white supremacy and we have a long ways to go. White supremacy is embedded in all of our institutions. In turn, you could see it in the response. I am not an expert in intelligence. When I say intelligence, I mean like intelligence as an agency. However, most people who consume, you know, the mainstream news, knew that something was going to happen. This was not something that was secret or underground, that something was going to happen. And people who are experts in intelligence, are experts in law enforcement, probably should be ready to do something. However, the issue with those in authority is that those with authority and power is that white people are not seen as threatening in any, even when threatening, they present themselves with threatening tools or what have you. They are always given the benefit of the doubt. They are always asked questions first. And this is something that communities of color have known about for decades. This isn't something new that this response would be disparate. It's definitely eye-opening, but it's not that surprising. Zach De La Rocha from Rage Against the Machine eloquently said in the early 90s, some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. And we saw that a lot of these forces, whether it be military, whether it be the police, they are an apparatus of this really sick institution that has taken over right now. They are part of the same apparatus and work to protect these forces that have been disseminating disinformation and hate. And you saw them lock in step with these politicians to provide an ease of access to the Capitol that you would not have seen, as Marcus said, with a different group of people, with a different composition.
Well, and there's also the thing of, I don't think another group of people would do this. And there's another part of this that needs to be discussed is all the Black Lives Matter protests. No one ever said, let's go in with zip ties to abduct senators and Congress people. No one said, let's just overthrow the government, even attempted to. That's another thing here is that the level of privilege of these rioters, of these insurrectionists, to think that they could just waltz in and do it, and they almost did, is something that people who belong to marginalized groups would not even think to orchestrate on this scale.
Right. So thank you both. I've thought about this incident and other incidents over the past several months, and occasionally have invited our elected officials to do a thought experiment, and this has been on my mind a lot. So the thought experiment follows up on what you both have been saying. Had the group of people who stormed the Capitol been Black, or a mix of Black and Brown and Indigenous, had they been armed even with just sticks like some of these people were, even if they didn't have a cooler full of Molotov cocktails as these people did, even if they didn't have people who were armed with like assault weapons as a few of these people were, if that group had stormed Capitol, even trying to advocate for better access to health care, more equity with education and their living situation, et cetera, they would have been met with much greater force, deadly force, as has already been said about what happened in the protests in the summer. I mean, I saw it in bystander video and journalist video, the violence that was perpetrated on peaceful protesters, some of them blinded by rubber bullets that are not even supposed to be shot toward the head at all, you know. Let's do another thought experiment, okay? What if Jacob Blake, right, who was paralyzed, shot in the back, had been white and had stopped to break up a fight between a couple of soccer moms and was getting back in his vehicle in front of his children when a Black police officer came and shot him in the back? What would that look like right now? Would that officer have been charged with wrongdoing as the Kenosha officer was not? So we have in this country multiple standards for justice. You know, we do. There is the kind of large one that separates out white folk against people of color. And then there's the economic tiered systems of justice so that the poor folk really don't stand a chance. And this is way beyond due for an enormous overhaul. And, you know, I know that President-elect Biden has mentioned doing things to address inequities in the justice system and economic, et cetera. And I just hope that there'll be enough political will for that to happen. I'm very concerned about what my colleagues have already brought up about the depths to which white supremacy is ingrained in this country. And I mean, I remember telling our elected officials years ago, we're dealing with the same problems we were dealing with in the Civil War. And if we don't at some point find a way to finally fess up to it and really, really address it, we're not going to get any better. We're not going to get over it. We've got to address it to deal with the sickness.
It's no coincidence that in the longer form sidebar coverage after the rioting last week, we see references to Andrew Johnson. We see references to Reconstruction. In some ways, in many ways, we're right back to where we always seem to be.
Yeah, that's dangerous, I think, in terms of looking back at the Civil War and American politics after the Civil War. In order to keep the Union together and this, you know, call for unity, right? You had a lot of placating to Southern politicians, and placating Southern politicians all in the name of keeping the states unified, that allowed for the wholesale oppression of Blacks in the Southern United States via Jim Crow. That led for, even outside of Jim Crow, you had the Southern Democrats or the Dixiecrats, who had enough power to ensure that their racist ideologies bled into national policies such as Social Security, okay, locking out a large number of workers who occupied professions that were majority minority. So we have to be really careful going forward that we are not placating to racism for the sake of niceties. And Martin Luther King warned against that as well. He said that it is the, you know, moderate white who is actually one of the more dangerous people, because for the sake of peace, they settle for injustice for the sake of peace. And we have been in this past year, obviously, at a turning point. And when you're at the precipice of social change, just like, you know, all social disruptions do precipitate social change, we have to use this opportunity very wisely and be wise in looking at what history has, in fact, taught us. And one last thing in regards to sort of similarities to the Civil War and post-Civil War is that you oftentimes had mobs. Actually, white mobs were really the norm after the Civil War, because they felt that they were having their privileges taken away from them by having the audacity to entertain Black people getting the franchise. And so we're seeing this as, you know, votes being challenged, and the votes and the political will of people of color, white mobs literally challenging that circa like Reconstruction style. And this whole thing about, oh, this is not America. Actually, this is very American. White mobs taking justice in their own hands in a very violent way. That is quite American as apple pie.
Right. So just a real quick thank you, Chandra, for that. What I meant was about referring to the Civil War was the fact that at that point, we could see very, very starkly a huge issue with racism, with an inordinate number of people in this country viewing Black people as less than human, fully human. And that the system of ingrained systemic legal oppression and racism led to this enormous calamity in our country that is, you know, the war over that. And so what I meant by thinking about facing this systemic racism problem that we've been dealing with since the Civil War, certainly it goes back further than that, as the 1619 Project has shown, and as we can see with the fact that slavery was legal much earlier than the Civil War. What I meant by that was the violence and the division of that time. We won't get past that if we don't face it. If we don't face it and really, really accept the truth of it and the pain of it and acknowledge it and acknowledge, for white folks, self-included, whatever ways in which we may knowingly or unknowingly still be taking part in any tendril of that, to try to expunge it, which is obviously going to be a very difficult process, and for some people will be painful, but we really have to do that as a nation.
Well, and it starts with consequences. I think, like Chandra brought up, the aftermath of the Civil War was ultimately the biggest consequence for the white Southerners who were fighting for slavery and all these things, was they had to shift their power from owning people to just taking away all of their rights as much as possible. They didn't really lose anything, aside from the mass destruction of the South went through because of the war, but there were no real consequences for harboring those ideologies. There have never been. If there were, we wouldn't be here right now. There's a thing of, you know, the polite racist who will, you know, say it quietly or only when there's other white people around, or they'll put it into policies in their company or in their university or wherever it is. Like, they'll carry out these racist ideologies in more subversive ways and covert ways. But now we've hit a time where they've gotten tired of whispering. And so they're screaming and wanting to burn things and wanting to hurt people. And they have cost people their lives at this point. And if we go forward and there are no consequences, and, like, granted, people are getting arrested, but if you look at some of the charges some of these terrorists are getting charged with, it's not nearly as harsh as what people got for marching through cities in the summer. Like, there are more consequences for people just peacefully marching. You walk into the Capitol building with weapons and literally threatening people's lives. And right now, for a lot of them, the worst thing is that they can't get on an airplane. For most of them, that's the consequence. For all these representatives who sat here and who fanned the flames with lies about how elections were being held, saying that votes didn't matter, because it's awful funny that when black and brown folks vote en masse for someone, that all of a sudden people want to scream out about scams and being rigged. And I'm not even just talking about Republicans. This happened with the primaries with Bernie, too. Saying it's rigged because black and brown folks didn't show up for him and he didn't campaign for him. Black and brown folks rejected Trump. It must be rigged. We have to talk about how this white supremacist ideology has huge consequences for non-white people who try to push against it, and no consequences, no real, tangible, long-lasting consequences for the individuals and institutions that uphold white supremacy in this country. They get a slap on the wrist, they get to call for unity and peace, and then people want to back down. We cannot back down this time. This might be our last chance to back down before this overwhelms us again.
Marcus, Chandra, Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Ray.
Keep up on the latest in Washington from NPR online anytime at our website, WUTC.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Back in the fall, Walker County became the first county in northwest Georgia to install a lynching memorial. It's a marker on the grounds of the Marsh House in Lafayette, the memorial of reconciliation, peace, and justice. Beverly Foster leads the Walker County Remembrance Coalition, which led the campaign to create the marker. What you will hear from her is part conversation and part oral history. Beverly, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here today. Thank you for asking me.
Tell us more about the project.
The Walker County, Georgia Reconciliation, Peace, Love, Remembrance, and Justice Project. It is Northwest Georgia's first Equal Justice Initiative Community Remembrance Project. We are very proud to have Walker County to be the first county to bring this project to Northwest Georgia. We formed a partnership with the Equal Justice Initiative out of Montgomery, Alabama. They work with the National Lynching Memorial down there in Montgomery, Alabama, that was dedicated a couple of years, maybe about 3 years ago. It was the first such national museum of its type. That museum commemorates the remembrance of over 5,000 people, 95 to 99% of them were African-American, who were lynched during that era of Reconstruction and segregation in the United States. This was a method of racial control in the United States, and it happened predominantly in the South. There was some, of course, in the North, but it predominantly happened in the South. The majority of this was done in Mississippi, the lynching, with about 664 lynchings, but the next largest number was done in Georgia, and they had about 589 lynching. So Georgia was right up there at top. And we got involved through a little lady by the name of Miss Emily Jones. She went down to the memorial. She was taking a class on criminal justice in the United States. So when the memorial opened, she went down there and viewed the memorial. And she discovered that one such lynching occurred in her hometown in Walker County of Durham. Back then, Durham was also called Pittsburgh. You know how they changed the name of cities. And it greatly disturbed her. She decided that she wanted to do something about it. So she came back to Walker County and she contacted David Boyle, the Walker County Historical Society president, and asked what could she do. And of course, David immediately had her to contact me, the president of the Walker County African American Historical Society. She asked me what could it do. We got together as the first three of the coalition and we worked out what we could do. Through the research, we discovered several avenues, but we decided the best avenue was to partner with the Equal Justice Initiative down in Montgomery. And we formed a coalition of about 11 people. And we formed the coalition and got the ball rolling. And we wrote a proposal to the Equal Justice Initiative. And we wanted to include the Lookout Mountain Judicial District that included Walker, Catoosa, Chattooga, and Dade counties. That's the whole far northwest Georgia corner in the Lookout Mountain Judicial District. And I wanted to include all four of those counties because I had a fear in my mind that those counties would not have a force that was strong enough to bring their marker and their lynchings to forward to be recognized. There were more lynchings than what I would tell you in these counties. But in the years that the Equal Justice was looking at, and you had to have a very specific criteria that they were looking at. You had to have proof that these lynchings was done, like two or three write-ups in the newspaper and things like that. They were looking at specific years. It had to be between 1877 and 1950. And to meet that criteria, there were two in Dade County, two in Catoosa County, one in Walker County, and three in Chattooga County. So I was afraid that those counties wouldn't have people that were be able to step forward. But the Equal Justice had their rules, and the rules was that each county had to do separately their own recognition of what happened and seek the reconciliation process. But they did allow us on one side of the marker to state that Northwest Georgia, that far corner, that they did have those lynchings during that era. But we were only able to actually do the process for our county, you see. So we did work after 2.5 years of community involvement, and I did go to Catoosa, and I did do some education in Catoosa and Chattooga counties, and a whole lot in Walker County, education on what we were doing at the churches and schools and whatnot, because to bring this type of thing forth and have support, you've got to do a lot of community education. Just to talk about lynching It's a touchy subject. You know what I'm saying? And for people to accept that this occur in their county, you have to show them proof and understanding, because it's shocking to them. But we had all the newspaper articles, all the books. I mean, the information was just there. All the historical societies, like in Chattooga County, when I brought it up, the president of Chattooga County Historical Society, he sent me all the information from the newspaper. I mean, they knew it was there. But to have them to come forth and want to reconcile for it is another subject.
And it's a difficult conversation to have, whether we are talking about the white population or the black population in that area.
Yes. It varied. Even the black population was very like, oh my goodness, they were very touching and frightened to touch it, you know. And I was very surprised. I had my better acceptance from the white community. They jumped on board with this almost like that this should be done. And my black community was a little skittish, but they, after education and talking, and they saw that this could be done, then they jumped on board. So we knew we was going to have to do a lot of training. And so I was just constantly on the road from church to church, from place to place, doing all this education and doing videos, so that when the day did come in September 2020, when we had the marker in place, scholarships of up to $5,000, which the students still can apply for the scholarship. We have the website set up. The website is set up so they can get the information on how they apply for the scholarship. We are still going to do the soil collection. So we still have a few things we're going to do. But the big marker presentation was in September 2020 down at the Lafayette Presbyterian Church in Lafayette, Georgia. And the marker is at the Marsh House in Lafayette. And at the Lafayette Presbyterian Memorial Park, they did put up a foot memorial. It was very well attended. We had over 50 people, you know, whereas, you know, the gathering during the COVID system was 50 people. We had it right at 60 people plus or minus. And people that were coming by was wondering what we were doing. And so we had what we call some crashers who sat in and listened and thought it was very interesting. EJI had sent us, they said it was going to send us some free material. They sent us free books to give away, free calendars to give away. I mean, I gave away about three or four different books on segregation, racial injustice, calendars, and all kinds of things to give away. And we had a whole lot of ministers to speak. We had the descendant of Sheriff Garmony was the sheriff that was at the lynching at the time. His descendant came and spoke. They had pushed Sheriff Garmony and his deputies aside when they decided to go ahead and get this lynching done. But he came and spoke. He is now a minister, and he spoke. We had the support of over 20 or 30 churches in Northwest Georgia, both black and white. And like I said, in the commissioner's office, and Sheriff of Walker County came, and he was very involved. And we had the Marsh House and the Board of Trustees on board. You know, they wanted the marker on there. Normally, they put the marker in the air vicinity of where the lynching occurred, but we wanted the marker where it could be seen. So the Marsh House was very on board of wanting the marker on their grounds, because the Marsh House does already have another African-American marker on there, recognizing the African-American heritage of the Marsh House. They have always been very receptive to highlighting the heritage of African Americans of Walker County. And so they wanted that there to continue that tradition. It went over extremely well. And so that proves to you that in a county that's only 4 to 5% African American, you can actually touch on a real touchy subject. And it went over extremely well. We did a reconciliation walk, a 2-block walk, from the Lafayette Presbyterian Church to the Marsh House. It wasn't a march, it was a reconciliation walk. And everything just went just beautiful. It lets you know that if you work real hard, that one little spark, Miss Emma Jones, one little girl, I guess she was probably about 20 years old. She wasn't big as a gnat. She still ain't big as a gnat. You can do a lot in your community if you want to.
What does it mean to not only offer remembrance, but offer reconciliation side by side? How important is it to have both of those side by side on something like this?
It's excellent. It's excellent. People don't understand that Pritner brought me to tears, that especially in areas like, see, I grew up in Walker County. My daddy's family came out of enslavement in Walker County, we believe, Walker, Catoosa County area there, right there on that line there. And my mother's family, we know she came out of enslavement out of Chattooga County, both her family. And my family was part Native American out of the Northwest Georgia. We know that for fact. They don't understand. This is important to have this reconciliation for the things that you know that your parents have been teaching you. And people like me, I'm a baby boomer. People like me who listen to these stories. My mother was the last person who actually knew people who were enslaved. Her grandfather was once a slave. To listen to them tell them the stories, and they passed those stories to me. My grandmother told me the story of how her mother died leaving Chattooga County because they had threatened to lynch her son, which was my great uncle, because he was smart enough to know math. But they had to leave Chattooga County and rush to Chattanooga to save his life from lynching just because he knew mathematics. But then she died of pneumonia, because she caught pneumonia on the way, because in a buggy, a horse and buggy in the wintertime from Chattooga County to Chattanooga, that's a good little distance. And so she caught pneumonia and died, and she's buried up there in that Pleasant Garden Cemetery. And that's the same cemetery that one of the people who were lynched on the Walnut Street Bridge is buried. I think his name is Ed Johnson, if I'm calling it correctly. And two of the Scottsboro boys are buried in that cemetery who were threatened to be killed for a rape they didn't do. And they finally proved that the lady admitted they didn't rape her, that she made that up. You know, all these things are connected. And then there was my father, who, like I said, he grew up in the Lafayette, Georgia area down there. And we knew the story of him, his family owning 60 acres down there in the Noble area. And there was always the story of how they got run out from down there, but they kept the 60 acres and they would rent it out to people to farm on it. And found out they were rent out with something they call white capping. White capping was when the people would try to take African-American land or businesses because they felt jealous of them, felt that they owned too much. And then, so they left and moved to Chickamauga, but they kept their land down there until long after my grandmother died. And then they decided to, because they had 10 acres in Chickamauga, then they at one point decided to sell it. But because of white capping, and you know, and daddy always kept a shotgun loaded in the house. And he would said, if the KKK, we lived on the hill. He lived on the hill. He says, if the KKK touched the hill, we would see the KKK driving up and down the road, having that parade. If they touched the hill, he had his gun, he was ready. And I always said, Daddy, why? Both my mother and father had faced them once before, and they was well prepared and ready. So then I knew what type of environment they grew up in, this segregated area. Because they had me late in life, and they grew up in an environment that was much different than I, whereas I was in Thai school, I was in integrated school, and mom and dad were proud, but that's not what they grew up in. They grew up in an era that was very, very different, and they had to protect themselves at all times, and daddy's demeanor was different. So to have this things together and for them to apologize, even for the things I had to do. I do remember sitting in the back of the bus. I do remember my sister. I went into the pharmacy to buy ice cream and my sister got irate when I sat on the stool to ask for my ice cream. And she yanked me off that stool and told daddy, she gonna get us killed. She sat on that stool in the drugstore. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that. And you know, you have to have be taught these lessons of how you're supposed to act, you know, once you get 6 or 7 years old and you start walking around with your brothers and sisters, what you could and could not do. So to have them to reconcile for these second class citizenship things and for going as far as lynching someone without finding out if these hurt claims was true is wonderful, because as the lead historian on this case, I checked the newspapers because this lynching was written up in the Chattanooga newspaper. It was written up in the Atlanta newspaper, the Walker County Messenger, newspaper in Missouri, newspaper in Chicago. And after reading all these newspapers and everything, one or two of them reported that, of course, these were the ones that was written up in the African-American newspapers, and the two were dating. You see, but no one looked into that. Well, this white lady and this black man were dating because that was against the rules anyway. So she might have had to cry out that he was trying to do something to save face because her brother caught them. You see what I'm saying? So this man lost his life because this man that she was with, this Henry White that they lynched, was of the typical thing that looked typical of many of the people they lynched. The typical person that they would lynch would be of three types. They would be young, mulatto, and very handsome. Or they were, quote, as my daddy was, had property and land and was doing financial well, and they were jealous of them, and they wanted that to be stopped because we was becoming economically upward bound. Or they would have been like my great uncle, becoming educated. They did not like those three. They did not like those three. But now they did lynch some women and everything, but the majority of them men, and they were men, African-American men, usually of that type, those three there. Usually, not always, but usually.
The memorial is in place, but the work goes on. How are you continuing that work, and how are you bringing the younger generation beyond the one woman that you mentioned into this?
When I chose this coalition, I was very purposeful in the way I chose it. I chose each person for the qualities that they could bring into the coalition. And I chose like the three triplets. They were very well known in Walker County, very well known in Chattanooga with the younger generation. Not with the older generation, but well, really the older generation know the triplets too. They're very well known. And so it made it for me able to present it to the younger generation. You know, people respond to faces that they know. You know what I'm saying? So that was the reason, one of the reasons I brought the triplets in. Plus, I felt that the triplets needed to know this information. And so I brought them in. And on the day of the dedication, I brought in some young people to help us, you know, distribute books and candles and things like that. On the projects, when I can, I always look and say, okay, what young people can I help get to help me with this? I have some other projects going right now. And of course, once again, I've brought in young people. I don't know what it is, but people come to me and ask me, would you help me with this project? And of course, 90% of the time I say yes, but this is what we're going to do. I've decided you're going to be the president of this project, but you need a secretary, you need a treasurer, you need a this, you need a that. And two or three of these folks are going to be in their 20s or younger, because we got to teach these young folks what they need to do. These people got to learn how to lead. And us old folks can't be leading all the time, because what we're going to do when us old folks are going to be dead and gone? I have my TV show. I just finished 3 months of it. I'm taking 2 months leave. I'm hoping to be able to come back in January. Just depends on how things go. I think it went very, very well. It went extremely well. But on the last show, I had my grandkids with me so I could show them what I was doing and why and everything so they could learn. We have to bring the young people in. And that was part of the Equal Justice Project, is that the scholarships includes an essay that they have to write, and they have to be in between the 9th and 12th grade. In order to qualify for the scholarship, you got to be between the 9th and 12th grade at Ridgeland High School, Gordon Lee High School, Lafayette High School in Walker County, Georgia. Or you have to be in the Northwest Georgia Technical College Youth for Success program. That's the GED program. And if you win that program, you got to be from Walker County between the age of 15 to 19. Can't be an adult. You got to be between the age 15 and 19. And you can apply for the scholarship. You can be of any ethnic or racial or cultural background. It's not just limited to any, not limited. Google the Equal Justice Initiative, Walker County, Georgia, and that will get you to our website that will tell you, go to that website, how to apply for it and everything. You have until, I believe, April the 1st to get your essay in. We give an extended period of time to get your essay in because of this COVID situation. Because you got to do your research and everything, and you might want to get your guidance counselor or your history teacher, somebody to help you. Your essay has to be submitted into the website. So we want to give these children an extended amount of time to get this essay in. Now, it's a $5,000 scholarship, but they might give all the scholarship to one person, or they might break it up. If they get five good essays, they might give five $1,000 scholarships. Or they might give $2,500 scholarship. It depends on how good the essays are. They're going to break that money up. You know what I'm saying? Like in Chattanooga, Chattanooga's already done theirs several years ago. And I think they broke theirs up. And I think four people won. They broke the money up and divided it amongst those four. They give it to you. We in Walker County are not going to judge. They're going to judge at the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, who got the best essay. Because, see, Walker County is big in land, but small in people, and we know everybody. So we don't want to put that, you know, we ain't going to do that. I know Grandma Sue's child, you know what I'm saying? So they going to judge in down in Montgomery. They don't know Grandma Sue's child, so it'll be more, you know, more equal on that. They asked us, did we want to be part of the judge? And we said, no, because we know everybody, and we don't want, you know, have that, you know.
Even though everybody knows everybody around you, if people are listening to this and they have more questions about this, I know you gave a bunch of information, but just wrapping up here, if people have more questions, where can they go quick online? How else can they contact you?
Yes, Miss Donna McLean. Everybody knows Miss Donna McLean. She is the point person for getting information about this. You can come to Miss Donna McLean or myself and ask us any questions about it. We can give you information galore about it. You can go to the Facebook page, which is open to the public, the Walker County, Georgia Remembrance Project Facebook page. It is open to the public. It'll tell you about the scholarship. You can Google the Equal Justice Program, Montgomery, Alabama, Walker County, Georgia's Remembrance Project's essay contest, and that will send you right into the website. You can email me at bevhismo@yahoo.com, and I'll send you information. We can give you a lot of information on it. We're just not going to be judging it. And we can send you all the information on how to apply for the scholarship. And we're going to be sending all that information to the guidance counselors at those schools, Ridgeland, Lafayette, and Gordon Lee High School. So you can ask your guidance counselor within the next few weeks, and they'll tell you. And the Youth for Success Academy, the director there, Mr. Vince Stalling, we'll be sending the information to him so he can get you the information, you know, of how to apply and what you need to do. So we can tell you all about that. We're just not going to be the one judging, that's all, you know. They will be taking it on your word. Like I said, ninth graders can apply. But if you win a ninth grader, they're going to go ahead and give you that money now, and they're going to take it on your good character that you're going to save that money and take it to college. So if you're in the ninth grade, you go ahead and apply, baby. You might win that thing.
All right. Beverly, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I always love to see you.
Keep up on the latest in Washington from NPR online anytime at our website, WUTC.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.